This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Khensei Norbu, is a high Tibetan Buddhist Lama, or monk, who has done something very unusual for a Lama. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup. It's also the first feature ever made in his country, Bhutan, which is in the Himalayas near Tibet. The Cup was filmed at a real monastery in a Tibetan refugee settlement in the foothills of the Himalayas. The movie is about two young men who escape from Chinese-ruled Tibet and flee to a Tibetan monastery in exile. Their biggest surprise at the monastery is that most of the monks love soccer. A couple are obsessed with it and are willing to go to extremes to bring a TV to the monastery so they can watch the World Cup. Khensei Norbu is a spiritual director of two meditation centers in Bhutan and Sikkim, and two Buddhist colleges in India and Bhutan. His movie, The Cup, has already opened in New York and Los Angeles, and opens in other cities this Friday. I asked him if many Tibetan monks are soccer fans.
Yes, there are a lot of young monks who are soccer fans. I had several ideas that I could have filmed, but many of these ideas would have cost me much more money. So I chose this particular story because it was financially most feasible. And also I was told that when a first-time director makes a film, one must do something that you are confident with. And I'm very confident with this story because I know the people there, I know the location, and I also, somehow it's like a autobiographical for me. So I'm very confident with the story.
I think a lot of our listeners will wonder, how do monks reconcile the competitive nature of sports, the emphasis on winning, with the Buddhist renunciation of ego?
Mm-hmm. Well, here I need to explain a little bit more. I think people generally tend to misunderstand between two things, that is Buddhism and Buddhist. Buddhism, of course, talk about, you know, egolessness, going beyond pride, going beyond competitiveness and all that. But Buddhists are normal human beings. So when Buddhists I'm not behaving well, like I don't behave well, it's not necessarily Buddhism's fault. And that's something very important to know.
So are there any Buddhists in the temple who are opposed to the monks being soccer fans?
There are maybe some more conservative, more traditional, older generations who might have a second thought on watching soccer or even like making film. But that's because, for instance, for many of these older generations, film is always something to do with the sex and violence. And I don't blame them for them to think that way, because that's the only kind of film that they get to watch. If only they see films by people like Andrei Tarkovsky, for instance. And they are so spiritual. And through that, you can learn a lot.
Is there a TV or a VCR in the monastery where you live?
Yes. The monastery that I filmed this film had a very sort of technologically not so good VCR. You know, look, the VCR, all this modern technology, is not a threat to Buddhism. The threat to Buddhist and Buddhism is the ego, our pride, our negative emotions. In fact, it's important for us to realize that these mediums can be used for our own benefit.
For teaching other people about Buddhism or about Tibet or just as an art form.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And it's not like Buddhism doesn't have this habit of using image to express Buddhist wisdom and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for 2,500 years, there's an example of using image, such as paintings, sculpture, so many of them. And for me, film is just a modern-day painting. It's a modern the sculpturing.
Now, you run several Buddhist schools, and do you live in one of the monasteries?
No, I have actually. I was trained by a tutor, and I have never actually lived in a monastery. But when I was about mid-20, I decided to sort of establish some school for younger generations.
So these aren't people who are necessarily going to become monks?
Most of them are monks, but they don't necessarily have to be a monk for whole life.
Mm-hmm. So you're a monk, but you don't live in a monastery?
Well, again, here, the concept of monk, what do you mean by monk? I think there is a Western concept of monk, and then there is, I think the word monk is kind of confusing here.
Right.
For instance, like in Japan, there's a big phenomena of Buddhism, and there's so-called Zen monks. Maybe that's kind of familiar in the West, Zen monks, you know, Zen Buddhism. And Zen monks have their family, you know, they have children, they have household. So the monks, when you talk about monks, if you are talking more on from the Christian point of view, maybe you are talking about celibates. Is that what you are talking about here?
No, I just mean someone whose life centers around spiritual contemplation and religious thought and religious training and so on.
Well, in this case, yes, I am trying to be someone. I'm trying to sort of concentrate my life on spiritual things and like that. But it doesn't mean that I may not get married and things like that. I might get married. I might have a household. I don't know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kensei Norbu. He's a Tibetan Lama who lives in the country of Bhutan, and he just made his first feature film. It's called The Cup. Have you seen movies all your life?
No. The film, moving picture, was introduced to me quite late. I mean, when I was young, I stayed in a very remote place. The only television that I have seen when I was young, in my late, I think my teenage time, was in a train station in India while I was waiting for a train. There was this monitor that broadcasts all this train schedule, I guess. But because the train is so late, sometimes they show these Indian film. And those were my first visual sort of moving picture experience.
How old were you?
I think I was like 18 at that time.
Wow. And what about the first time you were in a movie theater?
Maybe around 20 in India.
Do you remember what the movie was?
I think it was an Indian film. I don't remember the name.
Right,
but
But
the first Western film I remember, I think, I've been thinking about it. It was James Bond, Man with a Golden Gun.
Oh, that's great. That must have been, like, such a different world. Because, I mean, it's a world that doesn't really exist in the first place. But
I remember one experience in the Man with a Golden Gun when these beautiful girls with a bikini, when I see this, I felt very sort of myself, very embarrassed. Sort of, I was looking right and left. I don't know, feeling embarrassed.
Because of the sexuality?
Because, you know, until then I have never been sort of confronted with a big picture of
of a nearly naked woman.
Yes.
In a public setting, no doubt.
But still, you know, you feel that.
So, but early on, movies must have gotten to you since you became a filmmaker. Did the James Bond movie excite you, or was it not till later that that you fell in love with movies?
No, those days I watched film purely for entertainment. The idea of making the film never occurred in my head. I mean, of course not. Most of the films that I watch, the Hollywood films, they had car crash and aeroplane and all that. I mean, we were quite poor. We had no car to ride, let alone to crash. It was much later when I went to London. I went to National Film Theatre, and it is there that I began to see films actually made in India by Indian, Satyajit Ray, and some other like Ozu and Andrei Tarkovsky. It is because of their film that I had this inspiration or wish to make the film.
You worked with Bernardo Bertolucci on his film Little Buddha. How did you get to work with him on it?
Well, as I was saying, when I was in London, I was supposed to be studying, actually, to finish my master's degree. And also, I was teaching in a Buddhist center, Buddhist philosophy. And Bernardo somehow heard that there is a Tibetan Lama who is so crazy about film. And it was, at that time, he was just beginning to develop the story of Little Buddha. And he wanted someone to work with him, just to as a consultant. And he was searching for me, and then I was, of course, very much interested in filmmaking. And all my friends say, when you know, if you want to make film, this is the best chance. So I approached him, and then I become sort of his consultant. Got the chance to sit next to him when he was shooting later on, and that's how I met him.
My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Khyentse Norbu. He wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Khyentse Norbu. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup, about Tibetan monks who love soccer. Now, I believe there's virtually no movie industry in Bhutan. I mean, I think yours is the first film to actually come out of the country.
Yes.
Are there movie theaters there?
Yes, there's three in the country.
And what do they show?
Most of the time, Hindi films.
Uh-huh.
Indian film with a lot of dances and songs and love affairs and all that.
So, in the position of making the first feature film to come out of your country, what did you have to do just to get equipment to make the movie?
Oh, this was difficult. Initially, when I had this idea of making the film, I heard that I don't remember the director's name, but El Mariachi was made.
Oh, Roberto Rodriguez.
Yes. El Mariachi was done under $10,000. So I thought, well, maybe I can actually make a film, because the story, the present story, The Cup, is quite, I mean, can be made, I thought, because actors I don't have to pay, the monastery I know. And but then I realized that's not possible. I mean, the nearest place to rent a cheapest 16mm camera happened to be Australia. And like buying film stocks, all of that. So we estimated sort of $80,000. And I don't know, I tried to put mortgage of some of my belongings. And even then, it was still not possible. So I sort of postponed my idea of making the film. And then again, I had the opportunity to visit London. And I met Jeremy Thomas, who produced Little Buddha, and I knew him by then. And I showed him my script, and he read the script for several days, and he called me, and he said, there's someone in New York who is willing to finance my film.
And so once your film was financed, what did you do for equipment? Did you rent it from Australia?
Yes. And I asked, see, I go around some of the Western countries, and I teach Buddhism, and some of them have become kind of long-term student, and among them there are some photographers and movie-related people, and I asked them to volunteer, so they did it.
So they helped you shoot it and
yes.
Helped you get the equipment?
Yes.
Now, most of the monks in your film are the actual monks from the monastery.
Yes.
Near you. And you explained one of the reasons why you cast them, or the main reason why you cast them, was this way you wouldn't have to pay them. They were very good in the movie. Were they receptive to the idea? Did they want to be in a feature film?
It's not so much about how much they want to be in the feature film or not. This is actually quite important that I explain. You know, places like London or New York, if you make, many young people are into, have this enthusiasm to make film. So if you are making film, everybody, many people want to be part of it. But in that part of the world where I live, filmmaking is not a big deal. So if it happens, okay. If it doesn't happen, then it's also okay. You know, that kind of attitude they have.
Mm-hmm.
So for a filmmaker, it's kind of frustrating. But I guess as a Buddhist, maybe this is good. Maybe this kind of, you know, attitude is good. So I explained to the head of the monastery, who is a very close friend of mine, saying that I want to do this film. And the reason why I wanted to do this actually is probably it may never happen, but I want to eventually make a film based on the life of the Buddha. And to do that, I need to have a little bit of portfolio, so to speak. And I'm doing this, and it also contains a little bit of, about Tibetan and monastic life. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And since he and both myself are considered as kind of a higher-ranking, I don't know, teachers in this region, I guess we sort of used our tyranny a little bit, saying, okay, we decided to make a film. Okay, everybody has to join. So next morning, everybody's there without any, you know, feeling of bad feeling or also not too much enthusiasm.
How familiar were the monks with the concept of acting?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, the story is written in English because that's the only way I can get to show the producers in the West. So, and also, we have in the Tibetan tradition, we don't have this tradition of writing script. Like, I actually tried once, like kitchen, interior, night. I just can't put that in Tibetan. It doesn't make any sense. So I decided to write in English. So that means my actors, they don't know the story at all. It was such a rush, I didn't have a chance to tell them the story before we began shooting. And while we shoot, because of the weather and, of course, because of just the normal thing, you know, you don't shoot with sequence, right? I shot off sequence. So monks, they didn't know the complete story. They sort of vaguely know that this is about soccer. That's all.
When you were shooting the cop, did you have to do anything to make sure that you weren't being intrusive on other people's spiritual practices?
Yes, of course. I respected their practice, like daily meditation and all that. Of course, it has to be shifted up. You know, like monks had to get up. Usually they get up like 5, but then during the shooting, they get up like 3 in the morning so that they do their daily prayers and meditations. They finish around 4:30 and then they had a short, 5 they finish, and then they have a breakfast, and then 6 o'clock we shoot. So in this way, you can say I have disturbed their sort of routine, daily routine. But other than that, no, I didn't. I think, but who knows, you know. I think and I hope I didn't disturb them.
Did you show the monks footage of the film as it was being shot?
We never get to see the rushes. It has to be sent to Australia to process. And I had to wait like 10 days before someone there call me and say okay or not. And sometimes the telephone line doesn't work, and it's there was so much paranoia. I actually now realize, if not for all this Buddhist training of meditation and all that, I would have gone crazy by now.
What was the reaction when the monks finally did see the film, assuming they have seen it?
Not many of them seen it yet, because I still couldn't arrange a videotape. Some of them seen it, and now they're happy because it at last make a sense. When I was shooting, for instance, the abbot always complains to me, saying, why you put the camera behind my ear? You know, I was trying to get a point of view. And they could never understand, because, I mean, they know what photography is, but usually the camera is always in front of them.
Kensei Norbu wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. It's already opened in New York and Los Angeles and opens in more cities this Friday. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tibetan monk Kensei Norbu. He's written and directed his first feature film, The Cup. It's also the first feature produced in his country, Bhutan, which is located in the Himalayas near Tibet. The Cup was shot in a real Tibetan Buddhist monastery in exile in the Himalayas. The monks who live there portray the monks in the movie. There's a character in the movie who's a very eccentric fortune teller who never bathes and he smells mm-hmm. really bad. Mm-hmm. But even the people from the monastery go to him mm-hmm. to have him predict what the outcome of things will be.
Yes.
Who is the person who you cast as the fortune teller?
He is a real sort of saint. He's a real fortune, not to say fortune teller, but he predicts things. He's respected in the community as a great saint. And he is actually just like how he is portrayed in the film, if not more. He's always disappeared somewhere, and we almost know where he is. Usually he's in the bar or in a dice room, gambling.
You know, a lot of people might think, well, if he's so sacred, why doesn't he bathe?
Ah, this is what I think a lot of people have to know. By being saint does not necessarily mean that you have to be a slave of a society. You know, in Buddhism, we talk about elegance, union of elegance and outrageousness. To be elegant is important because that way you inspire people. But when you are too caught up with elegance, then you become a slave of a society. Then you are nothing. You are just you lose your genuineness. So I think this man practices in a very sort of normal term, crazy wisdom.
Do you ever go to him to predict the outcome of things?
I did several times. I asked him, I think, which film stock should I use, Fujifilm or Kodak?
Now, what does he know about that?
Well, he doesn't know anything. I just tell him, okay, just tell me the green box or the yellow box, like that.
And how does he decide?
Then he does the prediction, and then he says this, pointing to the Fuji.
And did you use the Fuji after that?
Yes.
Were you happy with the outcome?
Yes. These are mostly because, you see, I haven't been... technical things I don't know so much. See, I like to make film. This has been my ambition. But I haven't been to a proper film school. I don't know the photography stuff. So... there's always, when I actually begin to shoot this film, there's all these technical questions like, what film stocks should I use? And then when I ask my friends, they give me all kinds of answers, which takes a long time. So my sort of method was to save the time, just ask these guys.
That sounds great. My guest is Kensei Norbu, and he is a Tibetan Lama who has made not only his first feature film, but it's the first feature film to be made in his country of Bhutan, which is near Tibet. The movie is called The Cup. At the age of 7, you were discovered to be the reincarnation of a Buddhist saint. Who were you discovered to be the reincarnation of?
Oh, he was a great master. He was very famous for emphasizing the non-sectarian or ecumenical attitude with all the different schools and different methods of Buddhism. And he was also he worked very hard preserving a lot of, you know, in Buddhism, and especially in Tibetan Buddhism, we really emphasize so much on keeping the lineage. When the lineage gets very, very thin, then we try to really preserve it. And he's very well known for that.
So what sense did this make to you when you were seven? I mean, how were you told? Let's get to first, how were you discovered? Who is it that came and decided that you were the reincarnation?
Well, I really didn't know so much. And later on, I didn't ask this question to the people. Okay, anyway, I was in a school. I was seven, and I was in a Jesuit school, actually, a Christian school, just beginning to study, because that's what my parents decided. And after a few months, one day, there was a man sent by my family, and this man said, "You have to go. There's no time for school now." So I went, and there was all my parents waiting. And in our family, there's a new guest, a Tibetan, whom I have never seen before. And as soon as he saw me, he gave me a long scarf, and he said, "I am your student." And that's all. And I was, I didn't think about it so much. But later then I realized that these are the people who has been doing research on whereabouts of the reincarnate Lama or the boy.
It must be very strange to be seven and have an adult say to you, "I am your student."
Yes. But since it's kind of... this is a phenomena that happens in that part of the world. Again, it's not too strange. Mm-hmm, not too strange. Then I was taken away from my parents, and I went to Sikkim in India, and I was given all the training. And now sometimes when I think about the life and the works of this great master who is supposed to be my past incarnation, I have a doubt, because the things that I do, my behavior, my way of thinking is not that saintly all the time. But again, if Tibetan people think that I am this man, and if this benefits a certain society, then I guess I have to pretend I am. And I do not have any conflict.
How did they decide that you were the reincarnation of this 19th century saint?
This happens quite a lot within the Tibetan society. And each time it's slightly different. But for me, I think it was mainly the Lama who actually discovered me had dreams of the sign of, you know, the Tibetan have, Chinese, we believe in the animal zodiac sign for each person. And he sort of predicted the age, the name, and the sign of the birth of my father, mother, and how many children this family has, and it's the second child of this family. And also he had described the color of the house of the family, all of that. So this is how they found.
What do you think your parents' reaction was? Do you think that your parents were honored that you were discovered as the reincarnation of a saint, or do you think that they were heartbroken that you were going to be taken away from them and trained someplace else?
I think mixed feelings. Although my family, my father is himself quite well known, because his father, my grandfather, is actually very, very respected master and a poet in the Tibetan society. So this thing is kind of, my family is very strongly connected to Tibetan Buddhism. So this is kind of normal to them. But at the same time, my grandmother and my mother, of course, had a little bit of a hard time. But of course, they understand that this is the best for their child.
My guest is Tibetan Buddhist Lama Khensei Norbu. He wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Khensei Norbu. He's a Tibetan Lama who lives in the country of Bhutan, which is near Tibet. And he's made his first feature film, which is also the first feature film to ever be made in his country. It's called The Cup. You know, in the West, issues like personal identity and self-esteem are very important. I know I once interviewed Geshe Thupten, who is a translator for the Dalai Lama, and he said that the Dalai Lama was once asked about self-esteem at a psychiatry conference he was attending, mm-hmm. and he found the concept of self-esteem just incomprehensible to him. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering how being discovered as the reincarnation of a saint affects your concept of personal identity, of who you are, of self-esteem, or if that all that stuff is like too foreign to even think about.
I have heard about this concept of self-esteem and all that, and I have even actually read some books and talked about it with my friends. This is something that I think he's right. It's kind of difficult for me to comprehend. Many times I feel that so-called self-esteem that West talks about is actually a word, it's a disguise to protect this insecurity that we have. Now, to answer your question, I try not to have the ego, the pride of having, pride of being that, being the reincarnation of this great master, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, as I was saying earlier, I actually sometimes doubt that I am.
Would it be considered rude to confess those doubts to a Tibetan who believed that you were the reincarnation? Would it be, in a way, challenging them to confess your doubt?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I did actually confess that. And you know what my master would say? Oh, good. This is good practice for you. This is a humility.
Interesting.
You know, humbleness. Being humbled is so important.
Mm-hmm. So, but do you think other people would interpret it as humility or as not sufficiently believing in the faith?
This is a little complicated, isn't it? Okay, it's other people's duty to think that I am reincarnation of this great master, right? But for me, it's my duty to not to have this pride of being the reincarnation of this great master. So what would my master say? He said, to benefit others, you must visualize and you must think that you are the reincarnation of this great master. For yourself, you must think that you are someone who has all these negative things such as pride, jealousy, anger, and so on.
That's really interesting. Now, what about free will? Does it influence the amount of free will you feel you're allowed to have
mm-hmm.
when you're identified as the reincarnation of a 19th century saint? Even when it comes down to like your free will to decide you want to make a movie.
What is your main question here?
If being a reincarnation of a saint affects your free will, your ability to do what you want to do, to pursue your heart in terms of, say, your artistic desire.
Oh, no, it doesn't at all. You know, it has no barrier or it has no, some kind of, okay, now that you are reincarnation of such and such, you are not allowed to do such and such. There is no restrictions like that. Because then we are talking about the philosophy. See, I'm recognized as a reincarnation of such and such master, and this master is a Buddhist, okay? Now, whether I want to be a Buddhist or not, I have my own free will. And if I decided to become a Buddhist, then in Buddhism, the most important thing is to understand the view of interdependent and the practice of compassion. And practice of compassion, you can apply any kind of method. You can become a politician if you want to. You can be a prostitute if you want to. You can be a filmmaker if you want to. So there's no restrictions like that.
And you never have to say to yourself, what would he have done if he were in my shoes? What would the 19th century saint have done in response to this dilemma I face today?
Actually, I thought about that. And because, you know, sometimes my master would joking, half jokingly and half sarcastically, when I don't do well in my studies, they would say, you are supposed to be incarnation of such and such master. Why you are not doing well? Okay, and later I begin to think, well, it is a different time, and if he came now, he has to do things according to present day. He would use phone, he would use fax, he would use internet, probably much faster than me, because like now I don't know how to even switch on a computer still.
Do you have to decide now how much you want to be in the world and how much you want to be kind of removed from the world in a more secluded, meditative environment?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm thinking of doing. Like after June or July this year, I'm hoping to do about a year or maybe 2 years retreat. I really need it. Otherwise, I may be caught with this trap of ego and publicity and all of that, and I have to watch that out. I mean, in Buddhism, we talk about strength, right? To be strong, spiritually, whatever, mentally. And Buddha said, a person can become weak when a person falls into 8 different traps. I will not go telling all the 8 traps, but he said, okay, if you want to be praised, that is one trap that you become weak. If you don't want to be criticized, that is a second trap makes human being weak. So there's 8 of these. And when you go to film festivals and when you are exposed to this kind of world, I almost find it just the opposite. Like, okay, I have made a film. And of course, people, your film should be praised. Otherwise, there's no market. Your film shouldn't be criticized by critics. Otherwise, there's no market. So it's just the opposite, you know? But having said that, Buddha said, if you are walking over a trap, and if you know that this is a trap, then you walk over this, okay? You are walking over the trap and knowing that this is a trap. Then he said, this is a joy, this is a humorous. So what I'm trying to tell you is I need to learn that these are trap and I should have the courage to walk over it. And this is what I need to learn. And to do that, I need to do practice.
Have you been to Hollywood?
Los Angeles, yes. And yeah, I guess that's Hollywood, isn't it? Somewhere there.
I mean, it's not that I work there, but you know, from afar, it certainly looks like it would be like an ego festival there.
So,
I mean, what's it like to watch, like, so many people with so much at stake financially and in terms of their own ego?
Yes, I have. I came back from Los Angeles, and one night I actually have to confess that I went to strip joint?
Is it
strip
yes.
club?
Yes. Yeah.
And I saw a lot of girls with breast that's, put a silicone or something. And I thought, that's so sad, because your ego is so insecure. And if one make like that, you know, Los Angeles, I found that. And you are right, it's a festival of ego. And I don't know whether we should call it a festival, because ego is usually, the nature of the ego is the insecurity. That's why you have to put in silicone. That's why you have to, do things that you don't have to do.
Can I ask why you went to the strip club?
Oh, just, you know, as a normal human being. I wanted to go to see. Well, no profound reason here.
What'd you think of the atmosphere?
Good, actually. It was like a monastery, because, you know, you are not allowed to drink alcohol. You are not supposed to smoke, and you are not supposed to touch the girls. That's what they said. And you just watch. So that's a very challenging, I thought.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Kensei Norbu wrote and directed the new film, The Cup. It's already opened in New York and Los Angeles and opens in more cities this Friday. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new made-for-TV movie, Mary and Rhoda. This is Fresh Air.